Welcome to the Society of Advanced Bronchoscopy. This is The Way podcast. My name is Dominique Pepper, and in this podcast we interview leaders and experts in advanced bronchoscopy and interventional pulmonology. And for today, we discuss ablation in peripheral bronchoscopy.
Yes, my name is Calvin Ng, and I'm a thoracic surgeon working at Prince of Wales Hospital at the Chinese University of Hong Kong.
An absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast with us, Calvin. Today we'll be discussing your publication. It was published in 2024 in the Asian Cardiovascular and Thoracic Annals. It's entitled Safety and Feasibility of Transbronchial Microwave Ablation for Subpleural Lung Nodules. So maybe you could kick us off. Bronchoscopic ablation has had great promise. Why do we need it if there are other therapeutic modalities out there like robotic-assisted resections, SBRT, percutaneous microwave ablation? So why do we need bronchoscopic ablation?
Yeah, I think bronchoscopic ablation is really the next level in terms of a minimal invasive approach to treating small lesions in the lung in select patients. Of course, it goes down the airway and is capable with correct navigation to get to the periphery of the lung to deliver an ablation therapeutic, therapy. So it really has no wounds, and it has a quite a low complication rate, and it doesn't need radiation that SBRT has and the complications that comes with it potentially, and also doesn't need a puncture that a lot of the previous ablations have in terms of percutaneous approach through the chest wall and puncturing the pleura. So it does potentially have the promise of less complications in doing the same local treatment. And clearly we are seeing more and more small lesions being found with screening programs and more awareness.
So the goal here is to treat lung cancer. Maybe you could detail what kind of complications are being seen with CT, with the percutaneous guided ablation therapies. I think in your review article, you mentioned pneumothoraces, bronchopleural fistulas, nerve injuries, and rib fractures. How big a problem are they with percutaneous modalities, and what would the estimated complication rate be with a bronchoscopic ablation technique?
Yeah, from a percutaneous approach, the literature varies widely, but it's reported to be somewhere between 11% to 50% pleural-based complications in terms of pneumothorax, bronchopleural fistula, or some kind of bleeding from the lung. From a percutaneous approach, obviously one of the problems is that if you need to treat multiple lesions in different locations or different lobes, it'll be difficult to do multiple lung punctures. It's can be complicated enough to do one lung puncture, but if you have to deal with several nodules, it could be even worse. Rib fractures, because a lot of the time, I think the heat or the energy goes back up the ablation catheter. From a percutaneous approach, it's said that the heat can go back towards the ribs more often and more problematically in terms of causing rib fracture than a bronchoscopic approach. We have seen much less complications with regards to those complications with a bronchoscopic approach, with a pleural-based complication rate in single digits, around 6% pneumothorax, and certainly in terms of rib fracture, it's probably about around 1% or around that region. So I think it's much less so far. Obviously, it's limited data that we have and limited experience to compare with much more data in the percutaneous world.
So this is obviously a new field. So maybe you could tell us why you performed this study, because as you mentioned already, this is a novel technique. We have the promise of minimally invasive therapies. Why did you perform the study, and what were your study methods?
I think a lot of people were worried that if we perform a bronchoscopic approach for lesions that are very close to the pleura, either the manipulation of the catheters or the access tools or even the ablation energy would result in a lot of complications. And these complications, were predicted to be related to the pleura because energy was delivered there very close to the pleura, or even complications relating to the chest wall side of the patient. So we really conducted this study to look into whether this is there's some truth to this, whether we are seeing more complication rates when we are doing ablation bronchoscopically to lesions that are very close to the pleura or subpleural. So we looked retrospectively at our data in consecutive patients who had only one nodule being ablated. So we don't want to complicate the issues of patients having multiple ablations of multiple nodules in one session, just one nodule over a 3.5 year period, and looked at basically in hospital complications for these patients, and also up to 3 months, sort of any complications or issues with them. And we're able to identify 82 nodules with 49 nodules in a nodules being the deep group, which is more than 5 millimeters from the pleura, and 33 nodules in the subpleural group, which is within 5 millimeters of the pleura. That's any part of the nodule. And compared these two, and the results basically pretty much show that there are no significant difference in terms of pleural complications relating to ablating nodules that are close to or deeper inside the lung.
So let's unpack your study methods and your findings. So you decided to use microwave ablation. What other ablation techniques are available, and why did you decide to go with microwave instead of radiofrequency ablation or cryo or non-thermal?
Microwave is energy that I think we've had in our center most experience with, and thus we're most comfortable with in interpreting its ablation zone and looking at its effects. Conventionally, I think in a lot of the literature, the radio frequency energy makes a smaller ablation zone and sometimes a little bit less predictable due to the fact that with radio frequency, after the initial quick ablation around the electrode, that area desiccates and no longer conducts the electric current, and the resistance is very high for the current. So it's basically it stops the heating effect quite early on. With microwave, is more of a zone energy that's creating within a zone, they're creating a microwave, and with the heat it creates additional heat conduction to grow that ablation zone in a slightly larger manner. So with different catheters that we have some experience with, we found that the microwave catheter that we're using produces a more consistent, slightly larger, and relatively spherical-shaped ablation zone that's easier to work with and that we have most experience with. We don't have experience with cryoablation. We've had a little bit of experience with PEF ablation in a study setting. But in terms of thermal, direct thermal, physical destruction of the tumor for the ablation, our current choice is microwave right now. Yes.
And then what is the heat sink effect, and how does that influence your ability to perform an ablation? And also, do you have to pay any attention to mediastinal structures or nerves? How do you go about doing this ablation so that it's safe and that it's effective?
Absolutely. So heat sink effect is something that a lot of people talk about, and it's very real, clearly, with bigger blood vessels in the area where you're ablating, it will carry the heat away and supply that area with, you know, blood that has a cooling effect, obviously. We find that really vessels that are larger than around 3 millimeters will probably have some heat sink effect at the end ablation result that we see on the cone beam CT, maybe with some scalloping of the ablation zone where the vessel is. Although it's not something that we particularly avoid, it's something that we cannot avoid because, you know, we don't have a choice as to, you know, where that tumor is within the lung. Ablating small blood vessels is not an issue in terms of bleeding, because actually with the slow heating process, it slowly thromboses. But it does reduce the efficacy of the ablation when the same energy is being delivered. And that's actually, interesting enough, reflected in this study that we have here. And you can see in terms of the number of energy boluses being delivered, as well as the energy in joules that's been delivered in this study that we conducted, the more proximal nodules, i.e. the deep nodules, received more energy in order to create a adequate ablation zone with adequate margins for tumors of similar size to subpleural nodules. Our theory is that in the subpleural area, there are less, you know, blood vessels and large blood vessels and less blood supply to those areas. So less energy seem to be required in that area.
Gotcha. And then in yours, as you mentioned already, a single center study retrospective analysis, you included both those that were confirmed to be malignant as well as those that were suspicious. And so maybe you could explain that to our audience. Obviously, having a cancer diagnosis, that would make sense. Go ahead and ablate it. But why would you include those nodules that hadn't been confirmed as cancer as yet?
Yeah, that's, again, a very good question. Basically, we would include those patients that has, you know, nodules that are very highly suspicious when we discuss them in a sort of multidisciplinary setting. Actually, most of those who don't have a diagnosis are those who have a smaller lesion that would be very challenging to get a diagnosis from either a percutaneous or bronchoscopic approach. And they will be the ones that not just smaller, but maybe less dense, they're more maybe ground glass. So in terms of diagnostic yield will be quite low or very difficult to reach. We aim to get a diagnosis for every nodule that we can and think that we can get a histology on. But those ones that we did with our histology, a lot of them would have had a previous lung cancer or may have had a resection already, like a lobectomy or even a lobectomy plus a segmentectomy in the past for multiple lung tumors that have been shown to be multifocal, which is quite common in this region of the world. And they may have another lesion that is slow growing, that's been monitored over a period of time, that's persistent and is negative for all other investigations in terms of infective or otherwise, and come to the consensus really that's likely to be another growing primary tumor in the tumor board meeting. Those would be offered different types of treatments depending on how quickly they're growing, developing in size, and also the locality of where they are in terms of local therapy.
Gotcha. And then which bronchoscopic catheters are you using? Are these regular bronchoscopes? Is it robotic? How are you navigating out to the lesion?
The most common navigational platform we're using are the EMB system that we have with the passive navigational catheters. I think that the version that we're using is very popular in US and also in Europe. So we navigate to it and to the area. If there's a bronchus sign, it'll be ideal. A case where we may not need any kind of so-called transbronchial access tool. But more often than not, maybe 50% of the time, there will be no direct bronchus sign to the area. Where the last part of the journey of the navigation, we will need to deploy a transbronchial access tool in order to tunnel our way towards the lesion. The catheter that we use for ablation is not one that we can use to push through the lesion. It's not designed with a sharp tip. In fact, it's got a blunted tip. And so we do need to dig into the lesion with the transbronchial access tool to create a tunnel to lay down the microwave catheter in our setting.
And then what anesthesia protocols do you routinely use? Are you laying down the catheter with a breath hold? Which ventilator settings are you using? How are you making sure that everything stays exactly where it should be while you're performing both the CT guidance and the ablation?
Yes. So with the navigation, once we get close to the lesion, if it's a lesion that we think may be seen on TOMO, we'll use a EMB system that has TOMO capabilities to improve on the CT body divergence issue and to reduce the number of cone beam CTs that's required and reduce the radiation of the patient in order to reach the lesion. And once we're there with the correction, we would do the breath hold in order to deploy our transbronchial tool to hopefully skewer the lesion and then dig out a tunnel and then lay down the catheter thereafter. Normally, after we deploy the transbronchial access, the first part of the transbronchial access tool, we would often do a cone beam CT to make sure that we are digging in the right direction, certainly, and digging the tunnel in the right areas and that we're not doing any harm or injury to the patient before we fully deploy the ablation catheter within the lesion. We actually employ a strategy of ventilation as recommended by most interventional pulmonologists and certainly people like yourself and Mike Pritchard advocate this kind of ventilation strategy to reduce atelectasis, minimizing oxygenation and having a high PEEP in general. So on. So, and having a high ventilatory, volume. So we do that, for our patients, like we do for other navigational bronchoscopy biopsy, cases. And the anesthetists that we work with are, usually work with us, for these cases and are familiar with that. Yeah.
Gotcha. So in terms of your primary findings, as you mentioned already, you had two groups from 82 nodules in total. You reported the technical success of 100%, but then had 25% complications, five pneumothoraces, seven had pleuritic chest pains, and then you had, I think, one phrenic nodal palsy, one rib fracture, one pneumonia. Maybe you could comment on the complications, because that was the objective of the study, to assess the safety and feasibility. Based on those findings, what did you assess the safety and feasibility of microwave ablation using bronchoscopy?
Yeah, so the two groups, the deep group and also the subpleural group, were relatively comparable in terms of age, smoking status, and COPD status, for example, and also the type of lesion that we ablated in terms of the size were quite comparable. So a mean of 13 millimeters versus 15 millimeters, and also in terms of the morphology, radiologically, whether they're solid, semi-solid, or pure GGOs, were also comparable statistically between the two groups. As you said earlier on, that in terms of the technique-wise, there may more energy needed to be deployed and more so-called repeated boluses of ablation energy being deployed for the deep group, maybe because of the heat sink effect from larger vessels near the area. And also the procedural time was similar between the two groups. So the length of stay was also similar, and the complication rates in terms of pneumothorax and bronchopleural fistula, as well as things like effusion or hemothorax, etc., were also similar between the groups. We anticipated that actually most of the pneumothorax that we see when we look back on the film and the fluoroscopy and so on were the result of the tools being deployed during the process of either the biopsy just prior to the ablation, because in several cases we did biopsy to confirm malignancy prior to ablation, or during the deployment of the transbronchial access tool or the catheter, rather than the actual microwave energy causing a, let's say, a blowout of the pleura in causing pneumothorax. So it's the energy itself is relatively safe from what we can see, but it's special care should be taken while the tools are being deployed when the lesion is very near the pleura to avoid a pleural puncture.
And in terms of outcomes of the patients, because this is kind of what folks are really interested in, it's fantastic that it appears safe and feasible. But in terms of long-term outcomes, 6 months, a year, do you have any sense of the data, or is that going to be out in another publication?
Yes, I think that's something that people are very interested in, and so are we indeed. So we're kind of looking into our experience over the last coming up to 5 years that we've been doing transbronchial microwave ablation. I guess with a median follow-up on imaging of around 2 years, 2.5 years for these five-year experience. And there's been about 7 or 8% local recurrence rate. So it's actually looking at that is relatively comparable to SBRT in terms of recurrence rate at that stage for treating lesions less than 2 centimeter in size. This is so far encouraging, and we are certainly looking into sharing this result soon with our friends and colleagues.
And then, Calvin, maybe you could talk about the learning curve. It seems as though not only do we have to do pulmonology, then you got to go learn bronchoscopy, then you got to go learn robotic-assisted bronchoscopy, then you got to figure out an anesthesia protocol, then learn cone beam CT, and now it's possibly, potentially, ablation. What's the learning curve for each of those different components? And it seems like a lot to put together, a lot of balls juggling in the air. How do you do it, and how do you make sense of it?
Yeah, I think we've been quite fortunate and quite lucky in terms of, first of all, having availability of the setup and the technology that is within our reach. Clearly, you need access to a general anesthetic list, in your room and your hospital capacity. And then, of course, you will need some kind of cone beam CT, be it some kind of mobile CT system or floor mounted unit. And you need some kind of navigational platform, and of course, an energy source in terms of catheter based energy source to deliver down your navigational platform. I mean, in terms of experience, we were interested in using hybrid operating room to do operations to start with, so to help us find lesions, small lesions to resect. So we got a very early sort of exposure to using cone beam CT within our operating or clinical practice. And then navigation bronchoscopy came along. We learned that to aid in our surgery, to do dye marking initially for small non-palpable nodules to identify them during that surgery. And so that kind of slowly picked up. We started using transbronchial access tools to get to those nodules to do the dye marking, and then eventually picking up the ablation on top of, you know, what we have before that. So it is a gradual step-by-step process by us. I'm not saying that everyone needs to go through that process, but we had a soft landing in general because we had it step-by-step.
And maybe you could speak to us on concerns that you have or any cautionary tales you have about ablation. Obviously, it's not the standard of care. Why is that the case? And what do you think would need to happen before it became a therapy that was recognized as being as good or even superior compared to other therapeutic modalities?
Yes, it's a very important question. I think certainly we need more centers, you know, participating in this and collecting more data at the registry type level first. We clearly need more higher level evidence and more prospective data and comparative studies. I think at the moment it is a nice complement to what we have in our armamentarium to deal with lung tumors or lung metastasis within our MDT setting. We're certainly not taking over a lot of the SBRT cases or not taking over a lot of the surgery cases. I think with the ablation that we have at the moment and the evidence that we have, we give the patient an additional choice to deal with lesions that are smaller and earlier at an earlier stage when people would be more reluctant to, you know, give radiation for a part solid GGO that is small, that doesn't have a diagnosis yet, the potential complications of other treatments. So it opens that kind of door for a more personalized treatment right now. It doesn't affect lung function after ablation, or at least not measurable lung function after ablation, unlike some other therapies. So it's kind of complementing a lot of the treatment, the complex treatment pathway that the patients have these days in our MDT. We do need better data. And I think in the end of the day, we probably will need some kind of randomized study with a comparative treatment strategy or comparative local treatment approach in order to make it more mainstream. And that is being talked about right now, I believe. Yes.
And then you mentioned that you'll ablate suspicious nodules or that aren't definitive. How does one make sense as to whether or not it was cancer or not, whether there truly was a benefit? Because that's going to be a question that some folks have. I mean, obviously, if you had proved the cancer beforehand, you can say, yes, it came back or it didn't. But if it wasn't confirmed, how do you make sense as to whether it truly was a cancer that was ablated or just, you know, a ground glass opacity that happened to be in the lung?
Yeah. So I think that in the end of the day, I mean, with prospective studies, depending on the design, clearly, one can, insist on a, biopsy, proven nodule to be ablated. And that was the case, like with the NavAblate study that we did, a couple of years ago with Kelvin Lau's unit at, St. Bart's, where we, only recruited those with a biopsy proven malignancy, either metastatic disease within the lung or primary lung. That was a small number. We put together 30 cases in a prospective manner, and the follow up wasn't long term. It was more looking at safety again, but we can. It's possible it shows that we can just restrict it to those that are biopsy proven cases. That would, of course, limit the recruitment, but also I think we can have cases or groups where this, lesions are highly suspicious, although without histological proof, and those that are very marginal in terms of whether they really are malignancy or not. And I think in the reporting of recurrences, they should not be grouped together, as you quite rightly pointed out. I think that is important, so that people understand in their mind that when they provide a personalized treatment strategy for their patients and provide this treatment option in the MDT, that they know which category of patients and the results they're talking about. Is it biopsy-proven tumor, or is it highly suspicious part solid ground glass opacities, or is it just, something else? So I think that is, as you quite rightly point out, is important to differentiate and put that into the granularity, if you like, of the data that comes out in the future. Yes.
Agree. And then what are the important limitations do you want our audience to be aware of your study? Obviously, as you had said in the paper, a small retrospective, a single center study. What are the limitations do you want our audience to be aware of when interpreting your study?
Yeah, I mean, clearly it's a retrospective study and all the biases that are associated with it. The numbers are small, 30, 40 cases in each group. In terms of the comparison. So, there's no real statistical power in detecting small differences in complications between these two groups of patients with deep or subpleural nodules. And I think one very important issue is, the long-term, outcomes of this is and could be very important. Clearly having a low complication is no good if the long-term or medium-term outcome is very poor. We're aware of that. And obviously when we give this option to our patients, we let them know the data that we have within our center so far in a very transparent manner. Allow them to hopefully have time to consider and make the appropriate treatment decisions for their often complex diseases. We do hope to have more data, more patient numbers, and longer follow-up sharing with our friends and colleagues in the future, in future publications.
Great. We'll be looking out for that. And then what does your study mean going forward? How does the study fit into the field of bronchoscopy, therapeutics, diagnostics? What are the next steps following your study?
I think the studies we've sort of published so far show that, the microwave transbronchial approach is quite relatively safe and quite feasible. And we do hope that, more centers and other clinicians can consider this as a potential approach. There are some shortcomings in terms of the technology right now in its different ways. First of all, the navigational platform, how it can be improved to shorten the navigational time, to make it more accurate, and how we can make it more accurate with less adjunct imaging, subsidiaries that add on to the navigational platform to show that we have successfully navigated to the lesion and how we can do that. And obviously there's also improvement that we can make in terms of the ablation technology. There are substantial cases and patients where the ablation zone does not reach the so-called predicted ablation zone that is given by the manufacturer due to physiological differences between patients. So we do hope that we can have a more consistent ablation catheter that will produce more consistent sizes and ablation zones for our patients. I think those are the areas that are for improvement and to reduce procedural time and also to reduce the amount of radiation that a patient receives, as well as reducing the recurrence rate, we hope.
Great. I really appreciate speaking with you, Calvin. And obviously, in the United States, ablation isn't prime time yet or real time. It's something that we're going to have to consider and work towards and see if it's feasible. Is there anything in this podcast that when you're preparing for it that we haven't covered as yet? Any other take-home messages, anything that you want to leave our audience with?
Yeah, I think... ablation through a transbronchial route is just one area of development that is, very active right now, very hot. There are other areas using different energy sources, not necessarily physically, thermally destroying the tumor, as you know, maybe things that can stimulate the immune system or even direct drug therapies or injections into the tumor. That can produce a direct cytotoxic effect or immune stimulating effect or augment the effect of radiation therapy. So I think for all of us, it's even though some may not feel that, thermal ablation is their cup of tea, there's a lot of other development within the navigational bronchoscopy platform for dealing with lung malignancies that we should be aware of coming up in the next few years, and I think getting involved in this area would be important to provide our patients with the best options in the future.
We'd like to thank you, Calvin, for joining us. And for our audience, we discussed the article entitled Safety and Feasibility of Transbronchial Microwave Ablation for Subpleural Lung Nodules. It was published in 2024 in the Asian Cardiovascular and Thoracic Annals. Calvin, really appreciate you taking time to speak with us and wish you all the best.
Thank you very much, Dominic. Thank you.
A very big thank you to Dr. Calvin Ng, and a big thank you to all of you for listening to This Is The Way podcast. I'm Dominic Pepper with the Society of Advanced Bronchoscopy.